From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, pop music critic Robert Hilburn wasn't always a big Paul Simon fan, but his feelings changed and Simon is now the subject of Hilburn's biography.
If I could get him to talk about those songs and how artistry works, how it comes about, and then importantly, how you protect that artistry against fame, against drugs, against divorce, against laziness, against fear of failure. If you get caught up in fame, if that becomes more important than your music, you're going to slow down. And it never did with him.
And we'll hear how the theme song for the podcast and radio show, The Daily, was created. Last night, Paul Simon took the stage at the Hollywood Bowl. It was the first of three nights that he's playing there on what he's calling his farewell tour. When music critic and author Robert Hilburn first approached Simon about writing an authorized biography, he was hesitant about the idea. Simon was working on his latest album, Stranger to Stranger, and was not eager to rehash the ups and downs of his long career. Simon and Garfunkel disbanded in 1970, but for Simon, it was the start of a string of commercially and critically successful albums. By the early 80s, though, his career had reached a lull. But in 1986, Graceland, which at first looked like a flop, became a modern classic. Robert Hilburn eventually got Simon to talk about his life and music, and his new book, Paul Simon, The Life, was compiled from more than 100 hours of talking with Simon, as well as interviews with his ex-wife, the late Carrie Fisher, producer Lorne Michaels, comedian and musician Steve Martin, and many more. Hilburn's previous book was about the country legend Johnny Cash, and when I spoke with him this morning, I started by asking him what made him choose Simon as the subject of his latest book.
After the Johnny Cash book, John, I thought it would be easy to find another subject. You know, boy, oh boy, this is going to be fun. And I sat down and I realized there's certain qualities you want in somebody to write about. You want somebody who's significant, who's going to be remembered 50 years from now, who's interesting, and somebody you have a certain access to. You don't want to knock on somebody's door that you don't know and say, I'd like to write a book about you. The two people on top of my list were Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon, because I love songwriting, and I wanted to explore the songwriting process. And I gradually realized that Paul, it's going to be hard to get his personal life told because he's so private, but he's got those great songs, and he was still writing great songs at the time. And if I could get him to talk about those songs and how artistry works, how it comes about, and then importantly, how you protect that artistry against fame, against drugs, against divorce, against laziness, against fear of failure. If you get caught up in fame, if that becomes more important than your music, you're going to slow down. And it never did with him for various reasons. He'd never talked to a biographer before, and I sat down and talked to him, and he was reluctant at first. You know, he says, why does anyone care about me? Which is also him saying, I don't necessarily want people to know about me. And I said, but Paul, look, people are going to keep doing books on you if you don't talk. If we do a book and it's the definitive book, that's going to stop. He said, okay, I'll do it.
His music, both as a solo artist and with Simon and Garfunkel, very much coincided with your career at the LA Times, basically from beginning to end. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you were always an admirer of his work. Did you go hot and cold? How would you describe your appreciation and understanding of his work while you were writing at the LA Times?
Yeah, I started at the LA Times 1970, full-time pop music critic. I first heard Simon Garfunkel, of course, Sound of Silence. And I love Sound of Silence. It reminded me of Dylan. It reminded me a lot of people of Dylan. And then Homeward Bound, I liked that a lot. It had a lot of a country flavor. And then after that, I wasn't the biggest fan of Simon and Garfunkel. I didn't like all the folk, you know, April When She Comes or all those things. But then the Mrs. Robinson, wow, that's pretty good. And then the Boxer, that's pretty good. And then Bridge Over Troubled Water, that's pretty good. But the thing about it was, I was more into the rawness and energy of country and blues and Elvis and the Beatles and Dylan, that harder sound. But Paul was it was soft, that Garfunkel song. And that's one reason he decides he wants to leave Garfunkel. There's been all kind of things said why he left Garfunkel. Was it ego? Was it a resentment? Was it conflicts? The main reason he left was he was so ambitious and talented a songwriter. He wanted to do Me and Julio. He wanted to do Graceland. He wanted to do Still Crazy. And that was the remark. That was one of the key things he ever did, was leave Garfunkel so he could do that.
Let's talk about his partnership with Art Garfunkel. I want to play their first real big hit, and that is Sound of Silence.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again.
It's an unbelievable harmony. I mean, their voices match together in that song and a lot of their work. But it was not an easy relationship, both personally and professionally. Simon once said, after he'd done some solo work, I'm quoting him now, I can't go back and do anything with Artie. I'm not meant to be a partner.
Yeah.
What is he talking about there?
Well, first of all, he talks very fondly of those days with Art, the childhood with Art. But increasingly, he would be in the studio working and working and working and doing all this work, and Art would kind of come in and complain about this. Or then Art goes off to make a movie. He's sitting in the studio for 6 months waiting for him to come back. And he said one thing, it's like being in prison. And I found a letter in Paul's archives where Art wrote 4 or 5 pages, handwritten, just so emotional, saying your
reaction to that.
Yeah, it was. You see, back at the days of Tom and Jerry.
Right, Jerry Landis was one of Simon's recording names.
Yeah, and it was his girlfriend was named Landis. That's how he picks that name, which was long before Sound of Silence, where they did a pop novelty song. And the head of the record company came to Paul and said, if you like Elvis, why don't you do a solo record as well? So Paul says, yeah, I'd like to do an Elvis kind of record. But they didn't tell Garfunkel. And he thought he was betrayed. He thought he was going to leave him. And even, John, this was the most remarkable thing, I found an unpublished interview that his mother did, Paul's mother did, and she said that Art's father, when they were 16 years old, went to Paul's father and tried to get him to sign a contract that Paul would only write and record after that forever.
While they're high school classmates. That's unbelievable.
Yes, isn't that amazing?
That's unbelievable. Art Garfunkel didn't talk to you because he was working on his own book. Did you read his book, and did you get any insight into his view of their creative partnership?
His book was not really their story. It was about his feelings and musings and stuff like that. But I contacted Art, and he said he would talk all day if I did a Simon and Garfunkel book. But he didn't want to contribute to a Paul Simon book, partially, I felt, because he didn't want to do anything that helped Paul. And I said, Art, look, I'll treat you with the same respect I treat him. It's not Paul Simon's book. It's my book. And he went on and on for several months, and finally he decided he wouldn't do it.
Now let's get back to my interview with music writer Robert Hilburn about his new book, Paul Simon, The Life. Before the Sound of Silence turned Simon and Garfunkel into household names in 1966, they were writing teen pop songs under the name Tom and Jerry. We pick up my conversation with Bob Hilburn on what transformed Paul Simon into such an influential songwriter.
You think this guy who's done all this stuff came out of the womb playing piano and writing great things in his junior high school notebooks, but he wasn't. He spent, after that Tom and Jerry record, he spent 5 years writing songs, recording demos, trying to get records with the worst songs you could imagine. I mean, this guy, these songs were not even marginal. For instance, Connie Francis had a big hit in the 50s called Lipstick on Your Collar. So he records a song called I Want to Be the Lipstick on Your Lips. I mean, can you imagine anything worse than that? And he did that for 5 years until three things happened. One is he took a class at Queens College where he started a literature class, and he started, this one teacher who was so important introduced him to T.S. Eliot and Robert Frost.
This is Dr. Rosette Lamont.
Yeah, and no one's ever mentioned her before,
right.
Isn't that?
Huge influence on him.
Oh, yeah.
Changes his thought about literature and storytelling.
That gives him this literary edge that he didn't have before. So he has that, but he still keeps writing these teen pop songs until one day he hears Joan Baez and then most importantly Bob Dylan, and he says, whoa, I can do folk songs. And he didn't want to keep doing songs like I Took My Baby Down to the River and Stabbed Her, old traditional songs. And then John F. Kennedy gets assassinated. That was his hero, Mickey Mantle, Elvis Presley, and John F. Kennedy. And his mother said he stayed in his room for 2 days crying, despondent. And finally, he goes into the bathroom at the home at Kew Gardens Hills, turns off the lights, turns the water on so the tile sounds like a recording studio, and just keeps playing the guitar over and over for days, trying to find something in the music that inspires him. And he finally plays these notes, and he comes up, hello, darkness, my old friend. It's the darkness of the room and the darkness of the country. And that, after that, that's what made him a great songwriter, and he never lost that again. He never wrote those corny songs again.
One of the things that is amazing to me in reading your book is how people discovered his music and made it popular. He was recording most of his work decades before social media or Spotify and even iPods, but television was around, and it was really important at certain points in his career. I want to play a song from Graceland. I'm a huge fan of this song. Let's listen to this song. Yeah.
A man walks down the street. He says, why am I soft in the middle now? Why am I soft in the middle? The rest of my life is so hard. I need a photo opportunity. I want a shot of redemption. Don't want to end up a cartoon in a cartoon graveyard. Bone digger, bone digger. Dogs in the moonlight.
I could listen to that for a very long time.
What's really good about that is the humor in it. A lot of people don't understand the humor in Simon's music. I mean, if you go to Duncan, a lot of these songs, there's a lot of humor. In fact, that's partly because the Simon and Garfunkel image was so sad. Even they used to joke, we ought to call our next album So Young and So Sad.
We all think of Graceland as this huge hit, but the album was more or less kind of dead in the water when it came out. And then Chevy Chase records a music video for that song, and everything changes.
Yeah, that was the low point in Paul's life before that. He made a movie, a very egotistical move on his part. He thought he could do everything. He makes One Trick Pony. It's a big flop. His next album's a flop. Carrie Fisher divorces him all at that same time. Plus, he reads in Billboard magazine, radio DJ saying, you know, it's time for new voices. We're not going to play people like Paul Simon anymore. So can you imagine? I've got no future. And so he says, what do I do? And he happens to hear this tape of South African music. He went down there and did that album, and it was just remarkable. That's his masterpiece, John, to me. It's like taking American pop music and superimposing it on South African rhythm and making it a hit in America, where America, unlike much of the world that is open to foreign influences, America doesn't want foreign influences. And so the record company was, my God, what are you doing going to South Africa? It's the worst thing you could do.
Well, there's this great scene that you recount in the book where the Warner Brothers executives are listening to Graceland for the first time. And basically the room is, what is this? And Lenny Waronker, who ran Warner Brothers Records with Mo Austin, says, this is wonderful. This is great. And the room wisely goes, yeah, you're right, Lenny. Yeah. And they get behind it. And it had its obstacles, but it does work.
Yeah, but it was hard. But it comes out, and the only pop song that doesn't sound like South African is largely L. And they put that as a single, but it's not a hit. The album doesn't go far until that video. It went from like 189 to 10 or something, you know?
His work wasn't always critically successful. He did a Broadway musical called The Cape Man. It premiered in 1998, and it was panned by critics. How did he deal with that failure?
Hard. You know, it was hard after One Trick Pony. He's a very sensitive guy in terms of in school, teachers used to write. He's very sensitive. He breaks out in tears. So he's sensitive of criticism and stuff. He doesn't read reviews. Partly because he doesn't want to be influenced by what people say, good or bad, but also he doesn't want to be hurt. So the play was just savagely attacked. He went to bed that night, and he woke up, and it was 10 in the morning, and he knew it was a failure because people would have been calling congratulating him if it wasn't. And it took him time again. And luckily, he had Edie Brickell, who was his third wife, who was a great balance in his life, very common sense. Before Edie, he was so obsessed with music, he didn't really have time for relationships. They were always falling apart, but Edie brought common sense to his life, stability. She calmed him down. She was a great influence, and that helped him a lot.
We're talking with Robert Hilburn. He's the author of the new book, Paul Simon, The Life. I want to play another Simon song now. It's called Darling Lorraine, and it's from his 2000 album, You're the One.
The first time I saw her, I couldn't be sure.
So how much did Simon try to incorporate his own life, the real world, into his music? Because this is a very personal song to him.
This was a terrible time in his life. He was breaking up with art. His relationship weren't going well. He was lonely. He was insecure.
And with the part of me that talks, I introduce myself as Frank from New York.
He had had all the success, but he was unhappy. And so the opening line, he says, I'm Frank from New York, New York. No one says they're from New York, New York. Frank was the name of his doorman at the... but he goes along, and he doesn't realize what the song's about until there's a line in it where he realizes the Lorraine is dying.
The doctor was... was smiling. But the news wasn't good.
He says when things like that happen, it takes the breath out of you because you don't mean to say those things. A private person doesn't mean to say those. So a lot of his things come almost from a subconscious. You know, he doesn't sit down and think. He's saying, what's the music making me feel? Trying things out. And things like that just happen to pop out.
Paul Simon is 76 years old, and he has embarked on what he's calling his final tour. The first of the 3 dates at the Hollywood Bowl happened last night. You were there. What were the highlights of the show? What did you take away from it?
Well, just his mood. You know, I went to the rehearsal. It's a sound check, but most of them people come out, they blow into the microphone, they wave, they get up, they have his drink, and they're gone. 20 minutes. 2 hours he's on stage. Just the musicians call it the matinee. And he takes songs and let's try something with that. Like, for instance, when I got there, he was doing The Boy in the Bubble. He's done that song every show he's done for 20 years. It's fantastic. But he thought he had a new wrinkle in it.
Wow.
So they're trying that out. So all through the show, there were different arrangements of things. But he's talking to the audience more than I've ever seen him do that. He's explaining things. He's making jokes. And after the show, he was so happy. He's so thrilled, you know, because I think he knows he's got this freedom ahead in his life that he doesn't have to tour anymore. He takes that off the table. He might write songs. He might make records. He might do an occasional concert for a benefit. But he never had a balance in his life up until Graceland. And now he can go travel with Edie. He can write a Broadway play, a musical if he wants. There's this freedom, I think, that he really treasures.
So what did he close with,
Austin? It's The Sound of Silence. The song he said hello with, he says goodbye with. That's great.
I'm going to end with a song called Questions for the Angels from So Beautiful or So What. Let's listen to this song.
A pilgrim on a pilgrimage walked across the Brooklyn Bridge. His sneakers torn. In the hour when the homeless move their cardboard blankets.
So you've said it's one of your 5 favorite Paul Simon songs. Why is that?
Well, it's about today. It's the homeless. It starts off with your cardboard mattresses and stuff. But the great line is, and he spoke eloquently about this last night, is it's about ecology, too. It's about the planet. And one of the greatest lines he ever wrote, John, is in this song. He says, if every human on the planet and all the buildings on it should disappear, would a zebra grazing in the plains of Africa care enough to shed a single zebra tear? Huh? How can you explain the planet and how we're all in this together so eloquently and so kind of unprotesty? You know, I think that's just brilliant.
Robert Hilburn is the author of Paul Simon, The Life. He's the former pop music critic at the LA Times, where we worked together for many years. Bob, it was great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, John. Thanks very, very much. It's great to see you.
Would a zebra grazing in the African savannah care enough to shed one zebra tear?
Paul Simon, The Life is in bookstores now. Yes, there are still a few of those around, including Vroman's right here in Pasadena. If you must, you can also find it on Amazon. There is now a radio version of The Daily. That's the hugely popular daily news podcast from The New York Times, hosted by Michael Barbaro. And that show airs weeknights at 7:30 here on KPCC, right after the Frames evening broadcast. The theme song for The Daily was written by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk. They are Portland-based musicians who record as Wonderly. The duo was recently featured on Song Exploder. That's the podcast in which Hrishikesh Hirway dissects a song with its creators. Here's the backstory on how the theme song for The Daily was created.
I'm Michael Barbaro, and I'm the managing editor and host of The Daily from The New York Times. We try to make sense of the world in 1 or 2 segments that approach news in a narrative or explanatory way. We needed music that was going to hold up and complement the editorial content of the show. You have to listen to it every morning. It needs to announce the world to you. It needs energy, but not too much energy, because a lot of people are consuming this in the morning, and you don't want to, like, throw too much at them, but you don't want to put them back to sleep because they just woke up. Lisa Tobin, who is the executive producer for all of New York Times audio, has had a longstanding relationship with a group of musicians, Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wunderly.
This is Jim Brunberg.
I'm Ben Landsberg, and we are Wunderly. When they called us,
we said, well, look at our library and see if any of the types of music that we already have are what you're looking for.
And I did, and I played as many of them as I could, and I would kind of keep a log of which ones I liked, and that's where things started.
We were surprised that when we got back, they said, yes, we love this one. The song that they chose, it's sort of a punk Russian rock and roll song.
Kind of almost like a circus-y feel sometimes.
It was the last thing in the world that we thought the New York Times would like. We were kind of shocked when they chose that piece.
So we started this process of trying to tweak it and make it into something that would suit all of their needs.
It went through maybe a dozen permutations. But it went from being this thing with a lot of attitude to sort of getting smoothed out along all the edges.
We kept going back and forth and getting iterations, but we all felt it wasn't quite right.
So we asked him what he wanted to hear. We sort of got personal with it.
I was in love with the theme music for Westworld, the really popular HBO drama. The sound is sort of like... da, na, na, na.
Michael sang to us this piece of music. I had never heard Westworld. The thing that really got us going wasn't listening to Westworld. It was listening to Michael Barbaro sing the theme from Westworld. That's what all of a sudden made sense. It was like, oh, that's what we're going for. Strident, dramatic, but a very rational overtone. I ran over to the piano, Ben picked up his viola, and we just threw that theme out there that is now still the melody of the piece.
All of the strings on this are violas.
When we're asked to write a piece of music that supports the emotional landscape of the news, it's going to have elements that are jarring. I have this analog delay pedal that I use, just turning the knob slowly down until it grinds to a halt. And so you end up with really spiky stuff sometimes. Then we recorded the drums.
They wanted a big open, you know, some big hits. And then a drop down where Michael would talk. So there's all sorts of room to talk about the day's top story.
The direction we've been going with this piece is that we don't want it to ever land and give you that comfortable feeling of authority, because it's not the news authority, it's the news contemplation. So I remember before you did the bass part, it's like, okay, whenever possible, don't play the tonic.
Right.
Play inversions of the chords so that it's never gonna really land.
We got some direction from Andy Mills, who's one of the producers, and he sent us this beautiful piece of Cliff Martinez music from Nick, the score to that series. And we were like, let's try something like that.
I describe it as a siren. It's this pulsating sound that's kind of going up and down. When you think about why a siren made sense for this show, it's because we launched The Daily a couple weeks into this new presidency. The country was convulsing from a series of changes. Challenges to our healthcare system, to our immigration system. And it's a little bit that siren, like a police car going by and just kind of throttling you and making you think about what is going on here. And the whole point of the show was to disentangle and to explain this extraordinarily consequential and incredibly difficult to understand moment in our history. And that siren to me is both the audio DNA of the show and kind of a metaphor for the show itself.
As opposed to having a conclusion, the unresolved aspects of it still are bubbling under the surface. That's kind of how we feel after we hear the way Michael sums up and discusses the news. It's not resolved.
So the little Wurlitzer, the upward da-da-da, keeps asking a question all the way to the end, and that's the last thing you hear.
To hear a longer version of that segment, go to songexploder.net and tune in for The Daily weeknights at 7:30 here on 89.3 KPCC. And that is our show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you tomorrow.